There are sporadic kinds of opposition. But what you have first is during the reign of Nero, a localized persecution around the city of Rome. And it is during this persecution that you have most likely the Apostle Paul being put to death and the Apostle Peter being put to death. John, however, didn't die during that persecution. However, we have later on in the first century, after Nero, when you have the Flavian emperors come, Vespasian being the father, his son Titus, and then Domitian. Vespasian that conquers Judea, Titus that burns and destroys the temple, Domitian that demands that people refer to him as our Lord God and institutes the widespread persecution of Christians. It is during that period that you have John, I believe, being persecuted here. And the book of Revelation is given during this period to people that are facing persecution. And it is given in such a way, I think, to do two things. One, to tell these people in a way that's not going to incur greater wrath by your persecutors, that the fate of your persecutors will ultimately be that of punishment. Secondly, it is offered to encourage those Christians that are facing this persecution. Now, we've observed that here as John is on the island of Patmos, a number of things are revealed to him. The Lord speaks to him and reveals to him, first of all, seven little epistles to churches that are very close to where Patmos is. Patmos is an island, but these seven churches are on the mainland of Asia Minor or modern-day Western Turkey. And these are directed to them, some of which we know from Paul's journeys and the establishment of churches there, churches like Ephesus, etc. But there are others that we don't know as much about other than those things that are stated in these seven little epistles. These are rather literal in nature, although what you find is in those seven epistles, you will have figures that are referred to that will be restated later on in the book, particularly reference to the tree of life. References to removing a lampstand, things such as that. Now, as you then progress into the book, John is allowed to see a vision of the throne room of heaven, or heaven, with the throne of God pictured in the center, surrounded by the 24 elders. And our best conclusion on that, when you just look at the numbers involved there, you have 12 apostles, you have 12 tribes. It seems to be a way of describing the patriarchs of the 12 tribes and the apostles there, all of this coming together in one. Outside of that is something described as the four living creatures. And comparing what is said about Israel in the wilderness and the manner in which that camp was laid out with the different standards set up of the Israelites, based on that, based on what Ezekiel chapter 1 says, and based on what Jewish sources write about what those standards represented, the description of the four living creatures seems to be a description of God's people that are here before His throne. And outside of that, you have angelic beings. After that, from those things that are revealed in heaven, you have a number of different visions that are given to him, often coming in sevens. You'll have seven seals. You'll have seven bowls. You'll have seven trumpets. Many times what will take place in these different groups of seven is you will have descriptions of hardship, persecution, and then ultimately God's deliverance. Now, the question that we wrestled with throughout is, do we understand that laying these events end to end, in which you have kind of a timeline and you have to try to identify at each stage whether it's talking about something in historical in its historical relationship to that timeline? Or do you simply have cycles that are being described of the way in which persecution takes place, but God ultimately delivers? I've made the argument, and I hope that you have at least understood, if not agreed with why I've made that argument, that what you find here is not necessarily a timeline, but you have cycles that are repeating, that are describing the manner in which, yes, there's hardship, there's persecution, just like is going on now for these Christians here. But ultimately, God will deliver. Now, one of the reasons that I so firmly take the position that we can interpret chapter 1, verse 1, to point not to the distant future, but to those things that were taking place at this very time. We've already come across a few things where we have, I believe it's chapter 13 that relates specifically to Daniel chapter 7, where you have there some identification of groupings of kings. And just as Daniel pointed to the coming of Domitian, the little horn that would issue blasphemous names, that's restated in some of the things that you'll find in these earlier chapters, where you'll have description of worship of the beast. You'll have description there of this man with the number of the beast. And I don't think we're talking there about some, again, horror story with someone with the numbers on the back of their head. Instead, I think what you're talking about is a way of referring to that emperor, that whole system connected with Rome and its emperors, that at the time of the writing of the book of Revelation was going beyond simply saying, you can't worship Jesus. They were going even further to say, you must worship the emperor as God. And people were losing their life because they refused to burn a little incense to the emperor, and because they refused to acknowledge Caesar is Lord. That may seem very benign to us, but that would have in essence been saying, I acknowledge that Domitian is God. It's what he wanted people to believe, but that's not what a Christian could acknowledge. So people were losing their lives because of that, and so that those persecutors that were trying to enforce that, the emperor worship cult that was so strong in Asia Minor, that here I think is connected with this beast that tries to force worship of the beast of Rome and its emperors. To those people that are facing that, here the Holy Spirit to John does not reveal to them wording that will make the emperors and make the Roman authorities even more angry with them. It doesn't speak of Rome. It doesn't speak of Domitian. Instead, it will talk about Babylon. And by using a name like Babylon, which at the time, in the first century, was not a political power, was not something that really was in a position to be able to impose any kind of threat to the people of God. But it was a name that for the people of God that knew of the past of God's people. Babylon was the source of ancient persecution of God's people. Babylon had been the one that destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, took the people off in exile. And so it becomes a parallel to what Christians in the first century were going through. We're going to see that in chapter 17. We're going to see that same sort of parallel that's laid down. I think that's exactly what you'll see here with some of this reference to the beast and some of the same figures where you'll have reference to beast and horns and that sort of thing that relate to those prophecies you found back in Daniel, some of which pointed to kingdoms that would come after Babylon, some of which would point to those kings that would rise in the fourth kingdom, in which you'd have one with a blasphemous name, or one that would utter blasphemies or speak pompous words. And that's the very character Daniel pointed to that is echoed in these verses and in these chapters. And I think chapter 17 will point to. Now, I want to urge you to look for, and I've already touched on it, so many of you probably already know the very two verses that we're going to really zero in on to kind of nail down some of this conclusion. But I want you to look for two verses in chapter 17 that I think really help put the nail in the coffin, so to speak, on whether or not we are looking at something in the distant future or we're looking at something that had more immediate application. We're going to read chapter 17, but before we do so, any thoughts, comments, or questions just about our this time rather lengthy review? Any thoughts or comments? All right, would someone please read for us Revelation chapter 17, verses 1 through 6. Revelation 17, 1 through 6. Volunteer? Okay. Now remember, we've already, up to this point, we've come across these references in which you've had description of those that trampled the temple underfoot. You've had description of this beast that would utter pompous words, that would speak blasphemous things, then this beast that would force worship of the image of the first beast. We've already seen reference to those that would try to impose this kind of thing, that if one did not receive the mark of the beast, that they couldn't buy and sell. And we talked about the fact that during the first century, you'd have those that if they didn't identify with the emperor cult, would be cut off from certain kinds of financial exchange, cut off from the privileges of Roman society. Now, this is not the first time that we've encountered reference to Babylon. But notice here, after talking about some of these things, the way in which war would be made against the saints and the way that they'd be persecuted, here it starts out in chapter 17 by saying, here's judgment against this harlot. And we have some statements that are made here, and you have a description here, verse 3, of the Spirit carrying John away into the wilderness, and he sees this woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which is full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. You have, coming down here as it describes some of these kinds of things, the description, you're talking about something that looks regal. You're talking about something that looks royal, something that is surrounded by gold and precious stones and things such as that. But the key is, you're also talking about something that is full of wickedness. Notice there in verse 4, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and full of her fornication. You know, that's the thing about Rome. Historians can look at it and recognize the fact that compared to many other ancient civilizations, very organized, very regimented in many ways, very efficient in many ways, but also, unfortunately, very wicked, particularly during the period of the empire. And that's what you find here. You come down then to verse 5, and you have this first description that helps us make some definitions or helps us to make some determinations about who we might be talking about. Mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Now, again, you think about this as a Christian in the first century, and you hear Babylon the Great. I suspect that this would not be something that most Christians would even raise an eyebrow at or even put a question mark in their mind at, because this is not the first time this is used. We've talked about the fact that Peter, while in Rome, would speak of Rome as Babylon. She who is in Babylon greets you. Here, it seems to be the same sort of thing. Now, in doing that, the ignorant Roman authorities would think, well, what are these people talking about? They're talking about Babylon over in Mesopotamia, when in fact, what they're talking about is Rome. They're talking about Rome as that one who fills the earth with abominations. Notice verse 6, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs and Jesus. You know, here it becomes evident that you're not looking at something that can be understood and taken literally. I don't know what is involved with what would happen when one would drink blood, but I don't think it can bring about intoxication. You know, it might make one sick, but it's not going to literally bring about intoxication. Instead, what you're talking about here is this one who is figured as the persecutor is described as being drunk with the blood of God's people here, as a figure of describing the sense in which this one, Rome, I believe, has persecuted God's people to such an extent, it is figured as if this is a woman intoxicated with the blood of those that have been persecuted. Thoughts or comments or questions down through verse 6. All right, would someone read for us, please, verse 7 down to, and let's, for right now, go down to verse 9. Verse 7 down to verse 9. Chuck?
And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carried her, which hath the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. They that dwell on the earth shall wonder. Names were not written in the book of life, the foundation of the world. When they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is. And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sat.
Okay. Now, we're going to talk about verse 9. Verse 9 is one of these verses that I think is pivotal in your understanding of how to interpret the book of Revelation. Now, before we get to that, though, there's some numbers that are mentioned here. There's some things that are referred to with 10 horns, 7 heads, that kind of thing. Not the first time some of those figures are used. You'll find some in Daniel. You'll find some that have already been referred to earlier in the book. Some of which, I think, it may be if you look in Daniel, it's a little easier to see these numbers in terms of their relationship to what we know about Rome and how its first kings played out. What's a little bit difficult in this chapter is you don't seem to see exactly the same type of real easy to correlate relationship. Now, what it may be is it may be that the Holy Spirit here and John is assuming the reader's knowledge of some of those things that have been already stated in Daniel, and then already referred to a certain extent earlier in the book, to kind of just give a passing identification to those, that beast with these horns and that beast with the various descriptions here. One thing that I think is pretty clear that we've come across, you remember we had encountered both in Daniel and earlier in the book reference to one that seemed as if it had been slain but lived again. And we have made a correlation to that with what seems to have been the relationship with Nero, who was a persecutor and had actually been killed. But then, in essence, a new persecutor revives in the Flavian dynasty. And so you have Vespasian and his two sons that then become a great source of persecution, ultimately leading to Domitian, the worst of the three. And in that sense, I think it's probably what is being described here as that beast that was and is not and yet is. So it's, yeah, he's died, but he's come back again in this form of this persecutor, Domitian. Here you have this description of this beast, verse 7, mystery of the woman and the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. It's interesting there what is described in verse 8 as it will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. So it seems to be the sense in which there is some way in which this exerts its influence, its evil influence, but it'll come to an end. It'll be brought to the same fate ultimately Satan and his angels will be in, that they'll be brought to destruction. Notice, again, though, what we found throughout this book. Those that have their names written in the book of life, they're in verse 8. Those that refuse to worship the beast, they will not succumb to the fate that is associated with this very evil force. Now, verse 9. Here's a mind which has wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sits. Now, you might look at that initially and just think, okay, 7 mountains, there's 7 mountains all over the place. I believe this is one of the first, I mean, Babylon, I think, is already a very strong identification that what you're talking about is Rome. But this, I think, becomes a second very important identification that what you're talking about is Rome. And that is the fact that Rome itself is a city renowned for the hills that form that city. Let me show you here. I've got a little map that I put together, and I want to draw the connection here between this statement, 7 mountains on which the woman sits. If you look at a map of Rome, and it's these hills or these mountains are there today, but particularly as you focus on it from this period, 57 to 96 AD, what you'd find, first of all, is one known as the Capitoline Hill, very important area. Secondly, you'd find one, the Palatine Hill, third, you'd find the
Time Hill, 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 Time Hill,
Hill, Tyne 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 Hill, Hill, Tyne 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 Hill,